This podcast is produced by KPP Financial, Steve Peasley, President. For more than 20 years, helping Americans plan their retirement years with confidence. And now, today's podcast.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to Invest Talk. This is our April 18th, 2017 edition of Invest Talk. And as always, our mission is to convince you that the average investor is capable of rising above the ranks and becoming above average and making smart decisions based on sound advice and logic. Now, today, we're going to discuss how fixed income investors are attracted to closed-end funds because many produce a steady stream of income. So should you be open to closed-end funds? That's one of our talking points today, and we're going to discuss the differences of a closed-end fund, an ETF, and an open-ended fund, and why they're different, how that changes the dynamics of those types of investments, and which ones are right for you. Now, let's look at one pursuit that can trip up the average investor, and that's the search for dividends. Many people are caught up in the desire to find a juicy dividend because interest rates are so low. Even though they've come up a tad, they're still near record lows. And there are a few areas that many investors overlook because they're blindly following just the hefty current payout, right? They're looking at what it's paying today and ignoring or at least downplaying dramatically their company's ability to sustain its payout. Now, we've talked about this before, so don't let the dividend our goal is to not let you let the dividend obscure the company itself, right? To mask over the potential problems that could be involved with that dividend or the company that's paying that dividend or just the entity that's paying that dividend. Could be a fund, etc. Now, the most important features of any company's fundamental profile is their growth rate. Usually a company that is not growing is dying, especially during good economic times, or at least okay economic times that we're in today. Now, this lack of growth is what usually plagues many of the high dividend payers. Growth is usually stalled for various reasons. Many times it can turn negative at some point in the near future or currently. And the next business cycle downturn could push it into crisis mode. Maybe it's a structural issue with the company or its position in that industry. Think of a lot of retailers right now. Now, as a long-term holder of a stock, it's much more preferable to own a 3% dividend payer with a double-digit growth rate than maybe a 5 or 6% dividend payer with little or no growth. Because that grower is going to grow into a higher dividend. That 3% payout is going to be hiked on a regular basis because their business is expanding. Whereas a company that's stagnant or maybe losing market share or they're in a challenging industry and they may be yielding 5 or 6%, but that's because the market has priced them so. And the odds of them raising that dividend in the future are very, very low. And the odds of them cutting that dividend in the future are probably higher than average. Now, in order to increase the dividend for maybe a lower dividend payer, the company must have the capacity to hike the distribution rate as well. Meaning, they need to have extra cash left over after they fund their operations and maybe hopefully grow organically. Maybe they grow through acquisition. And this is where you look at the payout ratio and the cash payout ratio, which is a measure of how much earnings and cash flow are they creating to pay that dividend. Now, we like to see 60% of or less on both of those figures. Other, and that depends on the industry as well. A more cyclical industry, I want to see lower than that. A less cyclical industry, I could see a little higher. If it's a REIT, they have to pay 90% of their earnings anyway. So they're going to have a high payout ratio. So that wouldn't deter me from that area simply because of a high payout ratio. So see how you can get into specifics depending on the industry. Now, typically mid-cap stocks are the sweet spot to search for moderate dividends with attractive earnings growth potential. Now, mid-caps are they're no longer small. They've proved themselves in the marketplace, and they've cemented themselves in an area where their business is sound and they have still the potential to grow, however. So we look for, we like to target that mid-cap area, but it doesn't mean that you only target the mid-cap area either. We have a few small cap stocks in our portfolio that you probably never heard of, but they pay 4, 5, 6% dividend and have growth potential. Now, are there any shortcuts in your beating the bushes for dividends? Let's talk about it. I want to hear from you. I want to answer your questions. That's our first goal every single day. Our listener line is open. The Invest Talk listener line is open at 888-99-CHART. That's 888-992-4278. That's how you reach us with your question or comment anytime, 24 hours a day.
Hi, my name is David from Orlando. Can I use my HSA account to invest tax-free since I now have a high-deductible insurance plan through my employer? I'll listen to your answer on the podcast. Thank you.
The answer is yes, you can use it to invest. It depends on your company plan and where it's set up. You might be forced to buy individual mutual funds as opposed to individual stocks and bonds, which is, you know, more preferable to buy the individual stocks and bonds, but depends on your employer. So the answer is yes, it is a health savings account. There usually is some sort of investment option, but that depends on your employer, so you have to check with them. Good question. 888-99-CHART is our number, 888-992-4278. I always urge people to get their call in sooner rather than later. Now, should you be open to closed-end funds? It's one of our talking points today. Also, it's tax day, and I think it's a nice time to do a review of what our tax code looks like, what are the statistics behind it, where does the bulk of government revenue come from? Is it our taxes? Is it corporate taxes? Is it sales tax, property tax? Where does the tax come from? So we're going to discuss that. Also, 7 tax misunderstandings that could cost you. Things like maybe the fact that you shouldn't want to have a tax refund. Think about that. So we're going to discuss that. And then finally, hopefully if we get to this one, it's a little longer, but an investing roadmap for retirees. What should you cover when you are getting near or close to retirement? So that's what's on my mind today, but ultimately I want to hear from you. 888-99-CHART is our number. 888-992-4278 is how you get through and ask your question this hour. Let's take a quick look at the market today. We had the Dow down 113 points, the S&P down about 7, the NASDAQ down 7 as well. So overall, it was a modest down day. You had gold slightly down, oil slightly down. You had bond yields down as well. So bond prices were up a little bit. And the continued risk-off trade seems to be continuing to some degree. It hasn't intensified, And like I said, I think we still could see a small bounce here in the near term before we get into the month of May. But the market continues to weaken as we're approaching the 100 days of the Trump presidency, and the market really has stalled out since mid-December and pretty much since Inauguration Day, because Trump's agenda is nowhere close to being implemented. It's kind of in stall mode right now, and he's trying to get it going, but then he's preoccupied with North Korea and the Middle East and China, etc. And now he's talking about making changes to NAFTA. So there's a lot of things that are sidetracking the Trump agenda, which is what has drawn the market higher since Election Day. And I continue to believe we're going to slowly break the confidence in the Trump trade and eventually head back down to the Election Day levels for the major indexes. But, you know, it's a process for losing that confidence, and I think that will slowly erode, and it already is. So you're seeing interest rates go lower. I think that will probably continue in the medium term until we see the Fed really promise to hike rates or see more rate hikes maybe later this year. So overall, the market remains fairly weak. I'm financial advisor Justin Klein. What we can talk about today that would be really important to you. What can we say? What can we discuss? It's an open line right now for any money topics. If you're listening to us between 4 and 5 Pacific time, we can have a conversation at 888-99-CHART, or you can call and leave your message, and we'll answer it on the next show. But let's hear from you. Let's go to James in New York. How are you doing, James?
I'm doing well. How are you tonight?
Great. What can I do for you?
I wanted to maybe get a follow-up on the gold situation currently.
Mm-hmm.
I've had it for a bit. I mean, a year, give or take.
Mm-hmm.
But haven't really seen too many dramatic rises or in one direction or the other. Do you think that it might be making some new highs? And if so, I was wondering maybe what a realistic price target on GDX or ABX might be in the medium term in the next year, for
mm-hmm.
example.
Yeah. I'm not sure what you're saying when you're not seeing a lot of price movement, because it's been pretty pretty volatile. I mean, August of last year, GDX at a high of about 31 and change, went as low as 18 and change. Now it's at 24 and change. So to me, that's a pretty big move, and these tend to be big movers. So if you held it for a while, I'm shocked that you're saying that.
Actually, I'm overstepped. Actually, I probably have had it I've had it since like November, realistically, and
okay.
I haven't seen an extraordinary amount of movement since then. I'm not talking about the big move that passed
mm-hmm.
last year, kind of like the last 6 months. I haven't seen. It's been okay, but
yeah.
I don't know if it had a long ways to go.
Yeah, well, you know, GDX kind of a lot of part of last year, you had a large pullback. The first half of last year was fantastic for GDX. You had the price go from, let's see, a low of around $13 a share to a high of over 30. And what happened in the middle of the year is all the average investor, which they do like clockwork, got so excited about the precious metal miner sector, and they jumped in with 12 feet, and usually that indicates a medium-term pullback, and that's what you saw late last year, and it started to bottom in December, and you're seeing, really, it's been one of the best performing sectors so far this year. Now, for GDX, I do think it's going to make new highs above 30 by probably early part of next year at the latest. So medium-term, I think GDX will get into the 35 level by spring, by, you know, this time next year. And then on ABX, you know, I think this gets into the 25 to 30 level at the same time frame. Thanks for the call, James. 888-99-CHART, 888-992-4278. Now, I think you need to open your eyes to closed-end funds. That's one of our main talking points today, or our actual main talking point. And really, this is about the investor that's looking for something that may be less popular, but more attractive in many ways. And I think there can be some merit for many people to invest in closed-end funds. Now, a lot of fixed income investors are often attracted to these closed-end funds because many of them pay a dividend on a monthly basis as opposed to semi-annually like most bonds, right? Now, whether you're looking at a closed-end fund, an ETF, or an open-ended fund, they're all the same general principle. It's a pool of assets, a pool of basket of securities. You're basically investing in a portfolio, right? Now, what you have to understand, though, is the difference between an open-ended fund and a closed-end fund. Now, open-ended funds are bought and sold directly to a mutual fund company. These are the typical mutual funds that you're seeing on your 401k platform, right, is an open-ended fund. And there's no limit to the number of available shares for an open-ended fund because the fund company can continue to create new shares as needed if there's more demand for that fund. Now, on the reverse side, portfolio may be affected if a significant number of investors liquidate their position in that fund, and therefore they maybe think about what do you do if you don't have enough money to pay those liquidations? Well, you have to sell stocks, right, or sell assets, and that pushes the value of those assets down and affects the overall performance of the portfolio and affects all the other investors in it, along with trading costs that may go along with selling the particular stocks or bonds or other assets, right? So all investors in the fund share those costs associated with trading activity, okay? So if you're in one of those funds and there is a big drawdown in that asset class or whatever, and you hold on, you're taking a little bit of that burden of that trading activity. Now, on the other hand, closed-end funds operate more like ETFs. You can trade them intraday, and they are launched through an initial public offering, same way an ETF is. But for a closed-end fund, they're raising a fixed amount of money by issuing a fixed number of shares. Then the closed-end fund then configures all that money into a portfolio, right? Takes all that money, invests in the portfolio the way the prospectus says, and then it trades on the open market, just like a stock. Now, this can be beneficial for a lot of maybe atypical type of investments, or investments that may be less liquid, like small cap stocks, emerging markets, high yield bonds, other less liquid securities. Okay. Now, just like open-ended funds, closed-end funds, there's there's a wide variety of types of offerings. So there's a lot to choose from. But there isn't really passively managed closed-end funds, right? They're usually actively managed. You're not really tracking an index. You're following a strategy that's being deployed by the manager of that particular fund. Now, open-ended funds are priced once per day. At the end of the day, the net asset value, right? And the net asset value is what's the total value of all the assets in the fund divided by the number of shares that are outstanding, and that you get your NAV. Now, for a closed-end fund, it's the same calculation, but trades are in the open market. It depends on the supply and demand of the fund, right? Because there's no new shares being issued or redeemed. If you want to go and buy that closed-end fund, you need to go buy it from someone else who owns it. You're not trading directly with the fund company. So the actual trading price is set by supply and demand. Now, when the closed-end fund trades at a discount, which is less than NAV, means that if you're buying that, you're getting more than, you're paying less than all those assets are worth. And sometimes the fund can trade at a premium, meaning you're paying more than all those assets are really worth. And usually this has to do with sentiment. In an industry where there's good sentiment, meaning people really want to get into it, and they're finding every way they can get exposure to that particular asset class, it could trade at a premium. And vice versa, if it's trading at a discount. For me, I like to look at these closed-end funds and see which ones are trading at a premium or a discount. If they're trading at a discount, it means usually the sentiment in the industry is not very good, and you may find bargains, maybe not in that closed-end fund, but just in the marketplace in general, and vice versa. If it's trading at a premium, I might say, let's cut back on this area of the marketplace. Okay? Now, one big difference as well with closed-end funds is that they can use leverage, meaning they can borrow money to really hype up the returns, especially in a bond fund. Now, that can cut both ways. If the bonds decline in value dramatically, you can lose a dramatic amount of your money, especially if it's in high-yield bonds or risky bonds. Okay? So hopefully that gives you a sense of the industry and what the differences are between a closed-end and an open-end fund. Now, we're at the halfway mark of this Tuesday edition of Invest Talk. I want to hear from you right now. Let's hear your money question at 888-99-CHART.
Our podcast continues next, but first a reminder about our April 26th webinar. It's called Fundamental and Technical Analysis, Back to the Basics. We're going to talk about the metrics that matter most and how to screen for attractive stocks. It's a chance for the hands-on investor to hone their analytical skills, help you identify chart patterns that work in today's market. Join registered investment advisors Justin Klein and Jason Toper Wednesday, April 26th, 6:30 to 7:30 p.m. Pacific Time. It's free, but attendance is limited. So sign up soon. Just go to investtalk.com. That's InvestTalk with two T's. And click on the InvestTalk tab. And now we continue with today's podcast. InvestTalk continues, and next time, the idea is to move from a balanced portfolio to a high-yield dividend portfolio, where you dollar-cost average, playing investment tricks on yourself. Justin will talk about that next time on InvestTalk. You set the topic right now. Call us, 888-99-CHART.
Hey, Justin and Steve, this is Raul. I am calling with regards to CMP, Compass Minerals. Was wondering what you thought of the company and what a good entry point was. It appears to have a good PE and a good dividend. The price has been dropping, and was wondering what you thought about an entry point on this stock. Thank you.
All right, he's looking at CMP, which is Compass Minerals, and it yields about, 4% or so, 4.3%. And this is a name we actually picked up for some clients recently, very recently, I would say, in the last week or two. And they produce salts for highway de-icing, water conditioning, food preparation, agricultural, and industrial applications as well. $2.2 million market cap. Their price has fallen because of some there was some warm weather in the Northeast that reduced demand for some of their products. But we think that's a short-term issue, and long-term, I think their business is pretty steady. It's not going to be a grower, so don't think it's going to double or triple in the next couple of years. But it's certainly, I think that dividend is very, very safe, and you could see some price appreciation as it gets back to some normal levels of valuation. You know, it's enterprise value to EBITDA, which is a figure that we tend to like, is now at about 11, and it typically trades somewhere around 13. And so could it get back to that very easily, especially if EBITDA kind of rebounds a little bit? So we're a fan of Compass Minerals. CMP is the symbol. Now, it is tax day, and I think it's very interesting to look at the revenues that the government is getting and where they're getting it from. Okay. Now, most of us probably identify the federal income tax with revenue that the government brings in, right? And is allowed to spend on all the things that it needs to spend on, or it says it needs to spend on. And it makes up actually less than half of all revenue. Our federal income tax makes up less than half of all revenue. Now, in the 40s and 50s, corporations picked up the major share of supporting the government. Today, taxes are the biggest driver of government revenue. Now, since World War II, the federal government's revenue has come from four main sources. The first place is individual income taxes, our income tax. We've had an income tax since 1913, but in 1945, the personal income tax provided a bit over 40% of all federal government revenue. In 2015, that is up to about 47% of revenue. Now, that's not because, and that rise is modest, but it's actually because of a drop in a lot of other revenues. Now, the wealthiest Americans pay most of the tax. Those making over $250,000 a year, which is about 2.7% of all filers in 2014, they picked up 51.6% of all income tax paid. Those with incomes of less than $50,000, which is about 62.3% of filers, paid 5.7% of federal income taxes that year. Now you're thinking, well, there's income tax, but what about corporate tax? Now the big issue, this is where I see the big issue, because in 2012, the effective tax rate for corporations was only 19%, meaning corporations have built in loopholes and found ways to avoid taxes. This is where most of the lobbying money goes. It's not necessarily to get the government to spend money on the goods and services that corporations are selling. It's more to find ways to avoid paying taxes, because that's just as good, right? If you're paying less in tax, that's just as good as getting new business and earning profits. And that's really where, you know, they talk about the simplicity of the tax code. Simplifying the tax code is the goal of many people in government. Donald Trump talks about it. Many in Congress talk about it. The problem is there's so many entrenched interests that this is what they've been lobbying for decades, and 9 times out of 10, they get it. Because it's a lot easier to get these tax deductions passed than it is to get approval for government spending passed. This is called spending through the tax code. Now, we do have the third highest rate in the world for corporate tax at 39%. But like I said, the effective rate is only 19%. Which has fallen dramatically since 1945. Back then, corporations provided over 1/3 of all federal revenue. And in 2015, it was only 10%. So it's gone from over 30% to 10%. And then Social Security tax is also a big portion that has really, really risen a lot. So I'll get to that information a little bit after the break, but it's something also to consider is FICA tax. It's very, very big. Now, a reminder to invest in an hour with us on Wednesday evening, April 26th, that's a week from tomorrow, for fundamental and technical analysis back to basics. I'll be hosting this hour-long webinar along with another advisor in office, Jason Toper. We're going to help you bone up on your analytical skills, and we'll have plenty of time for your questions as well as we go along. It's a live webinar. It's free, but you do need to sign up. Space is limited, but registration is open on investtalk.com, so why not sign up now? Again, it is free. The date is April 26th at 6:30 p.m. Pacific time.
If you live near San Ramon in Northern California, Steve will be there for individual retirement reviews on April 25th. But if you're not near our California offices, Steve can meet with you via Skype or telephone Just go to investtalk.com and set up a time. Click on the Invest Talk tab and then Portfolio Review.
Hi, Steve. My name is Mike. I live in Akron, Ohio, and I listen on the podcast. The question is about earnings per share. I just finished your book, and one of the things that you talk about in evaluating companies is getting the earnings. And when I look on Yahoo Finance or any of these other finance programs, it's all about earnings per share, trailing 12 months. And I'm trying to figure out just what the earnings are for this current year. Should I be looking at the quarterly numbers or trailing 12 months, or which number should I look at? Thanks.
I like the, if I'm looking the most current and accurate, not forward looking, but current and accurate, I like trailing 12 months, because if you're halfway through a year and you're looking at, say, last year numbers, well, they're not very accurate. Why not you take the two quarters of this year and the two last quarters of last year, put that together? That's the trailing 12 months. That's the most accurate current earnings figure. So that's what I would use. That's what we use. You certainly want to look forward and see what analysts are expecting going forward as well. But if you're looking for current earnings, I would use the trailing 12 months. Now, getting back quickly to the tax discussion, you know, we discussed how the personal income tax is stayed relatively stable at about 40 to 50% of federal revenue. But the real decline has been in corporate taxes. Corporate taxes are going down as a percentage of revenue, and they're only at about 10% because of the effective tax rate and all the loopholes that are happening in the tax code. And these big corporations do not want to change that. I promise you. So tax reform is a long, long ways off, because there's so many entrenched interests that want to keep the tax code intact the way it is, because it helps the big corporations, but your average small business has to pay that 39% tax rate, which is not very, very attractive. And then lastly, the average worker is being taxed a lot. And it's through the FICA, which is the Federal Insurance Contribution Act, which is basically the payroll tax. It funds Social Security and Medicare. And this is increasingly adding to the burden of the middle and lower income families, because this is only paid if in the first $127,200 of income that somebody makes. So if you start making above that, you only have to worry about income tax, not this FICA. So in fact, the vast majority of American families pay more in FICA than they do in federal income tax. In 1945, the government got less than 10% of its revenue from this source. Today, one-third of U.S. government revenue comes from FICA. Four-fold increase in growth. So these are earmarked to pay, like I said, entitlements, Medicare, Social Security, etc. Now, there are other things like excise revenue from gasoline, alcohol, tobacco, telephone calls, etc., custom duties, inheritance taxes, but that's only about, it's below 10% of revenue. So that's kind of fallen over time. So you kind of see where government's money is coming from, and you can see it's increasingly coming from the middle class through FICA and poor people, and less from big corporations who have been lobbying and getting loopholes in the tax code. Now, April is official National Financial Literacy Month. It's really our mission here with Invest Talk. It's Money Management International who is sponsoring this month-long awareness campaign. They've assembled 30 steps to financial wellness. So we're going to talk about step 11, set smart financial goals. Now, before you think about setting goals, review the first parts of SMART, S-M-A-R-T. Start with S. A SMART goal is specific. It pinpoints something you want to change and want to achieve. Okay, so don't just say, I want to have enough money to retire. You got to say, what is that number? Figure out what that specific number is. Okay, you don't want to say, I want to save more. You say, I want to save X amount. What is that specific number? And that gets to M, which is measurable. You have to be able to measure that goal over time. Once again, don't be general. Be very specific and that will you will have a much higher likelihood of actually achieving that goal. And that goes with A in the SMART acronym, and that's achievable. Setting goals too high can lead to frustration. If you're trying to save $1,000 a month and your budget and your income just doesn't allow for that, then you're going to be frustrated because that goal is just not achievable. If you think you're going to amass, you have almost no money now and you're going to amass $10 million in the next year, it's just not really an achievable goal. Unless you win the lottery. So make sure it's achievable. And then R, rewarding. Reaching the goal should be a reward for your hard work. Have a reward for it. Say, if I get to this goal, I'm going to take a vacation. I'm going to buy this car. Or I'm going to buy this thing that I do for my hobby. Whatever it is, have a reward. And then lastly, T is trackable. Set milestones and schedule for your goals. So don't just say, I need to save X dollar amount. You need to say, I want to save X dollar amount by a specific time. Okay, so give yourself time horizons and time goals as well. Now for more topic and for more of this topic and useful worksheet, go to financialliteracymonth.com. 8899 chart. We are here to help with any money questions. Do you have a question on any money matter? I want to help with it this hour. We only have about 10 minutes left. So use the phone at 888-99-CHART or go to investtalk.com and click on the contact Justin.
Hello, Steve. Diego from Aventura, Florida. I want to ask you about the Schwab ETF of real estate, SCHH. What do you think? Because I want to play in real estate and I don't pay commission in this one. Do you think it's a good one? And what is your target enterprise? Thanks.
All right. He's looking at the Schwab U.S. REIT ETF. The low expenses, no commission. That's good. The big question is this a good ETF overall? And I'm going to say, yeah, it's pretty solid. You know, nothing. It's not fantastic by any means. But if you have a low expense ratio, low trading costs or no trading costs, that's certainly attractive. It's a collection of REITs. So there are other ETFs and indexes that you could track that may be slightly different than this. However, I wouldn't necessarily say you need to go out and find it. One thing you have to realize, though, is this is going to be very sensitive to interest rates. Now, we actually picked up a few REITs about a month ago, doing very well on them because we did see interest rates falling. And so I like REITs in the short term, just probably until we get back to the highs of last year. But frankly, I'm not a fan of REITs longer term, because I do think interest rates are going to rise. There's certainly a lot of risk with the retail REITs in the medium to long term. So I'd be a little bit weary about this holding it long term, because if you look at the history, when interest rates rise, real estate REITs, they tend to underperform. Now you're listening to Invest Talk. We still have time for your question at 888-99-CHART. I want to hear from you. 888-99-CHART. Go to Bill in Northern California. How are you doing, Bill?
Hey, good, Justin. Thank you. I'm a client, and I noticed you bought L Brands recently, and I was kind of curious. I was aware of the stock, but I don't follow it. And I was just curious if you bought this as more of an income play or just, you know, a rebound from the low here.
Well, I think it is an income play because it does yield 5%, and it's also just a value play. You know, it's fallen dramatically, and we think the worries are a little bit overblown over in the retail space, and there's a lot of what we call throwing the baby out with the bathwater, right? And it's just selling everything that's retail. When there's certain companies that still have good sustainable brands that even though mall traffic might be falling a little bit and some malls are dying, in general, there are other malls, like a lot of outdoor malls that are still doing well and brands that will sustain themselves. And there's a lot of types of brands where online sales are somewhat of a threat, but think of L Brands has Victoria's Secret. That's its main business, Victoria's Secret and Bath and Body Works. And the Bath and Body Works part, we know we're not a giant fan of, but Victoria's Secret, I mean, we don't think this is a brand that's eroding or going anywhere anytime soon. If women want to try on undergarments or buy undergarments, they're probably a lot less likely to buy it online than they would be, maybe someone going out and buying a TV. They're okay with buying that online. So to us, Victoria's Secret is still a fantastic brand. They still create massive amounts of cash flow, even though the stock has fallen dramatically. So to us, it's just gotten to a point from a technical standpoint and a fundamental standpoint that it lines up for a buy. So that's why we bought it.
Oh, very good. Well, I was curious. So you would say under that characterization of their fundamentals, the dividend that they pay out would be pretty stable, you imagine?
Well, it is pushing up against the limits, we would say, of what they should pay and probably can pay sustainably. Now, if their business really hasn't deteriorated much, despite all the rhetoric behind the retail space. So I think they can still actually grow a little bit from here and maintain that dividend long term. And even if they cut it, I mean, it goes what, from 5% to 3%? It's still a 3% dividend, still very, very sustainable. So we're okay with a cut in dividend, even to like a 3% level, which, you know, even the cut in half at 2.5, that's still a nice dividend. And from a valuation standpoint, it's trading at less than 1.5 times revenue, or less, a little over 1 times revenues. It still has a modest amount of debt. Its free cash flow still is very, very strong. And so we're still big fans of the company at these levels. You know, back in late 2015, when it was trading on $100 a share, you know, we weren't a fan of it then. But at 47 and change, it's hard to pass up that dividend and that value. Thanks, Bill. 888-99-CHART, 888-992-4278 is how to get through and ask your question on the show. We have a few minutes left, so I want to touch on 7 tax misunderstandings that could cost you. One is you shouldn't necessarily want a fat tax refund. Now, a lot of people say, great, I got this big, big refund. Well, in all honesty, all you did was overpay your taxes throughout the year, and that's money you should have gotten throughout the year anyway, money that you could have used to either pay down debt or invest and earn some interest on. So if you have a huge tax refund, you know, a modest refund's not a big deal, but a huge tax refund, talking $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 plus, maybe you need to submit a W-4 form to your employer and reduce the amount of your withholdings on a monthly basis. Number 2, tax credits are more valuable than tax deductions. So a lot of people talk about deductions and say you earn $70,000, you have a $4,000 deduction, and so your adjustable gross income is $66,000 and you're in a 25% tax bracket. Well, that deduction is only giving you, $1,000 savings. But as a tax credit, that comes straight off your tax bill. So tax credits are always better than tax deductions. There are a few more, but it looks like we're out of time. Looks like we're done for this hour. I'm financial advisor and licensed realtor Justin Klein, CEO of KPP Financial, a registered investment advisor firm. You can reach me directly with a question or comment. Just go to investtalk.com, click on the Contact Justin button. I'll get back to you. On behalf of Steve Peasley and everyone at KPP, thank you for being with us. Let's plan on getting together tomorrow.
Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for listeners to understand that not all comments made will apply to them specifically. Nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell securities. Such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis, and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. Steve Peasley and Justin Klein are principals of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor. For more information regarding KPP's investment advisors, call 1-800-557-5461. InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, which retains all rights.